This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're getting updates on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. Later in the show, we'll hear from a contact tracing expert, someone working on vaccine clinics, and we'll talk to a medical microbiologist about what we've learned about coronavirus variants. If you have questions or comments for our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. With us now, we have Lauren Chapman, the digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, who's been covering the pandemic. Thank you so much for joining us, Lauren.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start with the news around the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. What is the latest and what's going on with it?
You know what? A whole heck of a lot. So on Tuesday morning, the Indiana Department of Health announced it was pausing use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine after national guidance even earlier that morning had come down to do so. The FDA and the CDC put out a joint statement basically saying, look, we're going to press pause. And that was after six of the 6.8 million people who had received a Johnson & Johnson vaccine developed a rare and severe type of blood clot. We now know that that number is up to eight people, including one death. And for the most part, they were they're women aged 18 to 48. There is now one man included in that. The reason why we have this pause with such a low number of people who are affected is because of how severe that blood clot is. The typical way that you respond to it actually causes a negative side effect because it is this rare blood clot that is coupled with a platelet issue. So that's the reason the national guidance is taking this so seriously. And it's also the reason why Indiana is following suit and hitting pause on that rollout.
So just to be clear, is the CDC and the FDA, they have put pause? Like, is it paused nationally or is it state by state deciding what they want to do?
So the national guidance is a firm suggestion and states, all states have followed suit, and including Indiana, which makes it very interesting for Indiana because a mass vaccination clinic that is actually running through Sunday was originally supposed to be using the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and that's the Indianapolis Motor Speedway mass vaccination clinic. And they quickly were able to move over to using Moderna two-step vaccines, which means that all of those 6,000 people per day who were going through that clinic are now having to schedule second doses as well. But it also means for other clinics that were using Johnson & Johnson, a lot of folks are either having to reschedule or still playing a hurry up and wait game. I had kind of anticipated hearing from the State Department of Health this morning about, you know, what to do. Their guidance on Tuesday was, if you have a Johnson & Johnson vaccine scheduled for the next 2 days, go ahead and reschedule. Find a Moderna or a Pfizer vaccine to make an appointment with. And so far, they haven't provided any guidance outside of that yet.
So it sounds like we don't really know exactly what the full impact is going to be on this pause and sort of like the reverberating effects.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the other interesting thing is the national guidance. So the CDC has this advisory committee that basically takes all the evidence together and has been providing the yay or nay votes on vaccines across the U.S. And so they held an emergency meeting on Wednesday, and they were like, and part of that was because at the time we didn't really know if this was going to be, hey, we're hitting pause for like a couple of days and then issuing new guidance for like underlying health conditions of a certain type shouldn't receive this vaccine or something along those lines. And they don't have enough evidence to make that kind of recommendation yet. So right now, the CDC and FDA are saying, hey, this pause could be, several weeks as we continue our investigation, as we learn more about these really severe side effects. And so for Indiana, that could be a really significant chunk of the state's vaccine effort. Though it is important to note that, you know, of the, you know, more than 1.4 million Hoosiers who've received vaccines, only 125,000 have been Johnson & Johnson one steps. So it's not as prevalent, but it is certainly a hiccup in the vaccine rollout.
Right. And that makes me wonder, you know, just how many people were waiting and hoping to just get one shot and now maybe would be deterred from having to sign up for something where they have to come back twice.
Yeah.
So where is where are things standing right now in terms of vaccine supply? Aside from Johnson & Johnson, is there still an issue with supply and demand?
Oh, I mean, yeah, that's this kind of mass vaccine effort is going to have that problem no matter what. Right. And especially with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, we have, especially in the state of Indiana, we have yet to see the ripple effects of that. I think that there's probably a lot more of an impact for vaccine hesitancy and reticence of getting a different vaccine after, you know, you made an appointment for Johnson & Johnson and maybe you may be nervous about getting a different one. Those ripple effects will certainly play out over the next few weeks.
Well, so what about in terms of the virus right now in Indiana? So now I guess it's one more sort of hurdle in the way with less variety of vaccine, less people being able to get vaccinated. So what's happening in terms of the virus? Are we seeing an increase? Is it flatlining? What's happening?
Yeah, so Tuesday was a busy day for ye olde digital producer. Indiana also surpassed 700,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases. And so that's a significant milestone. And for a while there, it kind of seemed like we might not hit it because of how much the virus had slowed down. We had gone from hitting 100,000, a new 100,000 cases every 17 days for about 400,000 cases. And then suddenly, to get from 600,000 to 700,000, it took us 82 days. So there was a significant slowdown immediately after the holidays, where, you know, after everybody got their, you know, their holiday presents, they were like, you know, we're done. But we have seen a new increase. It is not by any stretch the kind of meteoric increase that we saw after Indiana lifted most of its COVID restrictions for opening to stage 5 in September, but it is still an increase. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the folks who are being affected are actually trending much younger than what we saw before. So there's
right.
It is slight, but it is still statistically significant.
Right. And I think that's playing out across the nation with experts saying it may be because younger people can't get the vaccine yet. Is that what we're seeing in Indiana as well?
Yeah. Most other states were not as strict to age requirements as Indiana was. And so it is even more pronounced in Indiana that because the vaccine rollout went so strictly by age that the impact is certainly being felt by younger populations, especially looking at that, like, you know, 40 to, you know, 25 age range. That's where a lot of folks are kind of seeing that. Yeah. But the other interesting thing is the prevalence of variants. And that is the reason why it's the younger populations that are dealing with a more infectious version of the virus.
And I know we have to ask this every time we talk about COVID in Indiana. We have the mask mandate lifted now. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? And does it change anything?
Yeah, so it does change a lot. You know what? I take that back. It doesn't really change a lot. The mask order, because there were not consequences for the most part for the mask order that Governor Eric Holcomb put together. That has been rescinded. There are at least 10 counties across the state that have continued their standing mask orders, including Monroe County, including Indianapolis and Marion County. There are also individual cities that have maintained mask orders, like Gary and like West Lafayette. Lafayette has rescinded theirs, but Lafayette has maintained theirs. So there's a lot of change and fluctuation, and kind of what it means is that you have high population areas that are still required to wear masks. So that is stemming a lot of the wild increases that we may see. The other problem that we run into, however, is that you have counties like Allen County and Vigo County and Vandenberg County who have rescinded their mask mandates. And they are high population counties. So how that all plays out will be interesting to see. I'm hoping for the best personally. But yeah, there's It's interesting. The individual municipalities, their mask mandates are not in vain, but it is taking away a tool to stem the spread of the virus this close to the finish line.
And what about universities? I mean, are they doing their own thing? Is it different on campuses?
Yeah. For the most part, for example, Delaware County does not have a mask mandate, but Ball State University does. That seems to be the same for most places, that they are maintaining their mask requirements on campus.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke with a health economist this week about vaccinations and case numbers. What did you hear from them?
Yeah. So Micah Pollack, who is an associate professor of economics at Indiana University Northwest, talked a little bit about the vaccinations and kind of where we're at. And actually, we can listen to what he said.
We're in a little bit of a race trying to get enough people vaccinated before it hits. And so even though, you know, we're doing great and we've got, you know, 70% of the population above the age of 65 vaccinated, we still see cases ticking up a little bit there. And we see them ticking up a lot in younger populations where they haven't been as vaccinated as much.
And we also heard, I also heard from him. He was great to talk to. He also mentioned that, you know, Indiana's running about 2 weeks behind Michigan, and that's pretty significant for us, because just last week, Michigan hospital systems reinstated a pause on elective surgeries because of the increase in hospitalizations. We are not there yet in Indiana. That 2 week lead time may be the difference of whether or not we ever get there. But when mm-hmm. you include the scoop on top of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and everything else, that's where we kind of run into some issues.
Right. So it sounds like it's this race that we really need to try to get to the finish line as fast as we can. Well, thank you so much. Lauren Chapman is the digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. You can follow her reporting on the pandemic at WFYI.org. We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're getting updates on the pandemic. Up next, we'll talk to experts about the vaccine rollout and contact tracing. If you have questions or comments, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic and getting some updates on the vaccine rollout, contact tracing efforts, and more. If you have questions or comments on the topic, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from. And you call the number 866-476-3881 to leave that message. Again, that's 866-476-3881. With us now, we have two guests, Graham McKean, Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University, and Shandy Dearth, Lecturer and Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at Indiana University Richard Fairbanks School of Public Health. Graham, let's talk about some vaccinations and what the status is right now at IU. Are there students getting vaccinated, and what are those numbers looking like?
Hello. Yes, there are plenty of students getting vaccinated this week, and very happy to have that opportunity, especially before the school year ends. And, you know, given the situation with Johnson & Johnson, we have Pfizer at IU and are able, with our timeline, to offer quite a bit of vaccine to complete that two-dose series in those 21 days. A couple of months ago, I honestly probably wouldn't have thought we'd have this opportunity. We'd be at that level of supply and that level of eligibility by April. But in the last 2.5 weeks, we've done about 8,000 vaccines at IU Bloomington, and we'll surpass close to 1,800 at IUPUI this week. So getting both those clinics open, and then several of our regional campuses have opportunities as well through other partnerships. So I'm glad to have that opportunity. And then also with Monroe County, we are operating their community open clinic as well as of March 29th, and we've been able to do about 3,400 there as well. So a lot of vaccines going into arms, and a lot of movement this week with the news of Johnson & Johnson probably personally canceled and rescheduled several hundred appointments that were at the IMS for that vaccine.
Mm-hmm. And how many vaccines did you have from Johnson & Johnson compared to like Pfizer and Moderna?
We were only offered Pfizer by IDOH at the time. Johnson & Johnson supply just never really got to the level that they had hoped it to at the federal level. prior to the rollout, and and at the federal level, only 9% of vaccines administered are Johnson & Johnson, about 6.8 million or so. So honestly, if you would have asked me a few weeks ago, it would be a much more convenient shot for students. A lot of students like that convenience. A lot of people like that convenience of a one shot. And then having that ability to be, you know, in terms of the CDC definition, is fully vaccinated 2 weeks after that first dose, instead of the, you know, 5 weeks with Pfizer, or 6 weeks total completion with Moderna. So we've only had Pfizer. We will only have Pfizer for the foreseeable future. A more difficult vaccine to manage and handle and store and prepare and mix, but one that we're extremely happy to have at the moment.
Well, Shandy, we spoke a little bit in our first segment about the mask mandate being lifted in Indiana. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, is this something that we shouldn't really worry about too much?
I would say, as Lauren mentioned, we definitely took away one of the tools that we have. And although there wasn't a lot of teeth behind that enforcement, in the urban areas where it has been required, there has been more enforcement depending on the local health department. And what we've seen is that in, say, Marion County, they've had a mask mandate in place. They still have it in place. I happen to live in an adjacent county, and once that statewide mask mandate went away, the masks went away in my county for the most part. And so I think when we had situations where people are working in one county, living in one over, they were using masks more often in their home counties as well. And unfortunately, that statewide mask mandate going away means that we are seeing fewer people wear masks. So we know it's a proven scientific tool to help reduce transmission. And so I do think it is a ding in our effort to control transmission in the state to get rid of the mask mandate.
And I wonder if removing the mask mandate gives folks a false sense of security, and with that, more vaccine availability, is it causing people to sort of maybe even subconsciously feel like the pandemic's over?
I think that's definitely a part of it. I think, you know, just the fact that the weather is getting nicer, we're going outside more. And it's great to have that hope that it's almost over, but I've got to say, from the contact tracing we're seeing, increases in cases. We're still dealing with the deaths on a regular basis. That's not gone away. It's not like we magically fixed that problem either. And so we're still in the pandemic, and we still need to take those steps necessary to control it.
Do you think, I mean, I know there are reports about people, they're just fatigued, they're tired, they can't, you know, wrap their heads around this any longer. Do you think that's also true in terms of the way this topic is covered? Whereas in the beginning it was so intense, and we're hearing about refrigerated trucks and people dying, and now it's just kind of like we're just talking about numbers.
Yes, I think everyone's burned out on it, as we've seen, as you said, in the news. The focus has definitely changed. I think once the vaccination news started hitting, that's what we're really stuck on. And it's great that we've got the vaccine. Everyone needs to use that tool as well, but it's going to take a while to get everyone vaccinated. And I still like to remind everyone that we still don't have a vaccine approved for the younger kids. And so we need to make sure that we're still taking steps to protect the kids. And not to be an alarmist, but this is such a new disease that we do not know the long-term impacts on kids who might get it now. They might seem fine. I can't guarantee they're going to be fine with other issues related to COVID in the future. We just don't know.
And Graham, what's been the challenge getting students and staff vaccinated at IU, or has it been a challenge?
Well, initially, I think it was just supply and eligibility in the state's approach. And honestly, I think that was a fine approach, going for the most vulnerable people, those that are might suffer the most mortality and morbidity, and those that might, you know, take up the most critical care capacity. So I think that was the initial challenge. But our shift in the next several weeks will be hesitancy. And it's going to, as that supply increases, and we were just talking earlier this week, seeing in some areas like Mississippi, where there's, you know, over 75,000 available vaccine appointments on the board right now. So you're going to see that vaccine wall. And I think it's hard, especially after this long of a time frame, for people to really just to hone in on that and realize that this is really the only way that we can move forward as a society, is to get enough people vaccinated. Hesitancy, it's not a monolithic group. It's very nuanced. Some of it might, you know, be rooted in some validity, but it has to be very targeted. And so, you know, I think at the moment, I think we're seeing a great uptake and great enthusiasm. We're going to ride that as long as we can, but it's going to become more targeted and more difficult and probably present more logistical challenges going forward. Johnson & Johnson news, I know we talked about that earlier. Obviously a very incredibly rare instance, but one that they take very seriously because of the seriousness of that particular blood clot. And I think that's confusing to people. And I think, you know, there's just such a high standard for safety that even any pause like this, even if we move on and it's decided that the rates aren't really much higher than they are or not higher at all than the general population for this particular type of blood clot, I think it does damage. And that's been a big concern and focus of ours this week and how we go about messaging that. So it's going to be a challenge. Yeah. We only have about 22% of Hoosiers fully vaccinated. So overwhelming majority are not. And that's about 3% less than the national average. Yes, we're at 25%. Yes, we should celebrate that. It's some of the best in the world. But that's still 75% of Americans that have not been fully vaccinated. And if we don't get to certain levels, then we won't have that ability to do the things that we need and want to do here.
And speaking of Johnson & Johnson vaccine, Shandy, what are your thoughts on this vaccine being paused? Is it surprising to you that it would be paused within just like six cases? Is that a lot of cases?
It's not surprising. And I remind everyone that CDC and FDA, they're doing what we pay them to do. They're being very cautious. And CDC is known to be very reserved, not to take risks. And that's great. So in my mind, that should set up more confidence in the system that they did pause it at six and not 60 or 600. They're taking this seriously. They're looking at it. And again, it's great that it was the lowest supplier here in the U.S. I'd like to remind everyone that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is made in a very different way than Moderna or Pfizer. And Moderna and Pfizer, we've delivered millions of those doses, and we've not seen any of these issues. And so we really encourage people to go ahead and just switch your appointment over to Moderna or Pfizer vaccine and move forward. There's really no concern with that.
And Graham, you mentioned that folks are maybe going to be more hesitant now with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine being paused. Shandy, are you seeing that? Have you heard that? I know it's still kind of new, but have you heard people saying, I'm just not going to get anything now?
Yes. So actually, someone I went to high school with posted on social media as soon as the news went out, "See, that's why I'm waiting to get this." And it's unfortunate because, as Graham said, there was already some vaccine hesitancy to start with. And this will just increase that because, unfortunately, a lot of people who aren't living this day to day, like Graham and I are, they don't understand the intricacies of vaccine production. They don't understand what goes into looking at these cases. Again, this is six cases out of almost 7 million doses. And I would like to point out that COVID can give you a blood clot and COVID can kill you. And so the risk for COVID would still be greater than these six cases out of the 7 million doses. And so we've got to take that into account, but it's hard to put that into perspective for people who don't deal with this on a regular basis.
Right. And I think, you know, you mentioned someone posted on social media, and I think that's where a lot of things spread so quickly, where it gets blown out of proportion at times. And so, you know, Graham, I mean, are you seeing that with students or anyone else that you're working with, that they are getting their information from less than reputable sources?
I'm not sure about our students or constituents or colleagues even, but a lot of people are. Unfortunately, I read the comments. I can't turn away. And seeing the level of disinformation and misinformation, it's incredibly concerning, especially for something that is about public health and about protecting each other and others. And there's just a lot of misperception about the goal of something like a mass vaccination campaign. And as Tashandy just pointed out, and as Oxford put out a preprint this morning, the risk of getting a very rare same blood clot in the brain is about 95 times higher for people who contract COVID than in the general population. So the risk of COVID remains higher than any risks of a vaccine, and the benefits of the vaccine remain higher than any risks from them. So it's just going to be another challenge. It's been a challenge for probably about 13 months in the U.S. You know, I think a lot of us thought, knowing how we can take certain stances and politicize things in the U.S., that Oh, we were saying very early on, January, February last year at IU, it's, you know, we might have more challenges in asking people to self-quarantine, to self-isolate, to do those things to stop the spread of communicable disease because of, you know, either perceptions on personal freedoms and things like that, when really it was just to protect others. And so that's going to be a constant battle, and I think it's just getting more compounded as we get towards what we can maybe see a finish line. And, you know, it just doesn't help us right now that there's that continued misinformation. There's continued to be 700,000 cases per day worldwide. There's areas of the globe that have no vaccine, won't have vaccine for some time, and areas where we have very high levels of spread that continue to be a threat to us all because of the way viruses mutate. So really, this has got to be the most intense campaign and most successful one in a short amount of time if we really want to just move on as a society.
Right, right. And Shandy, you work on contact tracing. What is that looking like here in Indiana? Is that, I feel like I've heard it's really hard if people don't want to, take part and say if they've been around other people. But are you finding that it's getting easier?
I wouldn't say it's getting easier. I would say we've learned some tricks and tips along the way. For the most part, a lot of the cases around the state are still handled by a call center. But in Indianapolis, since last summer, we've actually had a door-to-door campaign. And so if you don't answer the call in Indianapolis, we actually send someone to your door. And so sometimes it's harder to deny those questions or, you know, refuse to answer those questions when someone's right in front of you versus over the phone. And obviously, a lot of people don't like to answer a call if they don't recognize a phone number, but actually sending someone out to the door gives that person the chance to realize how serious this is, that we really do need the information. And then we're also there to help offer some social services if they've needed it. So we've connected lots of people to food banks, legal services, housing help, things like that in the community. And so that way we are there letting them know that we're there to help them and not just take their information and put it into a big database, that we're actually trying to help get rid of COVID for all of us.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, the folks who are hesitant to get the vaccine, does that correlate to them possibly also being hesitant to provide information for contact tracing? Is that similar?
I would say there's probably a little bit of the politicizing of that as well, just like what we saw early on, as Graham just mentioned. People are just hesitant to share the information as well because they don't want to be taken off of jobs. We ran into people who, you know, they will voice their concerns. They can't afford to miss work. They can't afford to reduce their hours because of their health insurance. They don't want to miss any more school, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of pressure. You know, we've all missed a lot in this last year. And to find someone at this point and tell them that they need to quarantine, that's asking a lot. But again, that's where we really have to emphasize the need to protect the community. We have to keep thinking about the we and not just the me in these scenarios.
And I know we had a show a while back we did on March Madness, and we had an epidemiologist on who said that one of the biggest problems with that event was the ability to do contact tracing from people coming from across the country. Did you find any issues around that?
That's often an issue in any kind of contact tracing, because what happens is when someone returns home and they're tested in their home state, some states will then contact that event state and let them know that positive case was in the state at the time they were infectious, but not all do. And so here in Indiana, on a regular basis, we sometimes receive reports from people who are here for all sorts of events around Indianapolis. You know, the convention center has been open again for a while. And we get those reports in and we follow up on those, but I guarantee we don't receive all of those.
And Graham, we talked a little bit about the issues and obstacles with vaccinations. Is there anything, I guess, positive right now that's happening that you're seeing that seems like a light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, again, just I think we all need to have some perspective here. I know we talk about how burnout we are and how long of an event this is and the toll it's taken on all of us, but for some perspective, no vaccine has ever been produced and put into use quicker than 4 years. And that was a mumps vaccine. And here we were within about 11 months. We have these first two just wonderful, highly effective, really exciting vaccines with the mRNA technology. And so the fact that we are now 190 million plus vaccines in the U.S. of those two, and just wonderful safety profiles, we're seeing great data related to fertility and pregnancy and passing antibodies on via placenta or breast milk, just an incredible feat for science. And the real world data that we've seen with Pfizer from Israel was 90% plus effective. Moderna's at the 6 months was slightly reduced, but it's at 90%. We were thinking, you know, hoping for 50-70%, and then I think we've just got some incredible science here. So go get them. Come see us at IUPUI Campus Center. Come see us at IU Simon Schott Assembly Hall, and we'll move on.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you both for taking the time, Graham McKean and Shandy Dearth. We'll be back after a quick break. Up next, we'll learn about the coronavirus variants that have been in the news with the help of a medical microbiologist. I'm Miriam Soe. Back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soe. Back now to our discussion on the COVID-19 pandemic. We're joined by Ryan Relich, Associate Professor of Clinical Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Welcome, Ryan. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
So we've heard about COVID-19 variants a number of times over the last year, and there's been a lot of concern about these variants in the last couple of weeks. Can you start off by telling us what are these variants? What are they biologically? What does this mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be my pleasure to. So I think the first thing we should discuss very quickly is a little bit of basic biology about what a variant is in the context of viruses. So a variant is a virus that is genetically different from essentially the version of the virus that was first characterized by scientists early on in the pandemic. So early on, there was genetic sequencing information available from among the first cases of COVID-19 that were studied in China. And so the genetic data that was gathered from that really became the reference against which all other viruses that were sequenced are compared. And any virus that is different in genetic sequence, which is basically the sequence of chemical building blocks that make up the genetic code of the virus itself or its genome, anything that's different is considered a variant of that. And so these genetic variants really can result in differences to the proteins that comprise the viral particles themselves. For example, the spike glycoprotein that's found adorning the surface of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And in turn, some of those changes can potentially alter one or more properties of those viruses, such as things like the transmissibility of the virus and the susceptibility of those viruses to medical countermeasures, such as antiviral drugs or monoclonal antibody therapies and things of that nature. And so these viral variants really arise as a consequence of mutations that occur to that genetic information housed within the viral particle during the process of that material being copied by infected host cells. And so some viruses are very prone to high genetic mutation rates, whereas others aren't prone to frequent mutations. In the case of coronaviruses, those viruses actually encode a mechanism that helps in what's called proofreading. So they're much more stable. But genetic variances do occur. These mutations do occur, and they do lead to viruses that have a different, what's called a phenotype. So structurally, they're a little bit different in their composition. And so really, you get variants arising all the time. However, most of them are probably of little concern, but it's these ones that we have seen emerging lately, such as the UK variant called B117, or perhaps some of the others that have been emerging throughout the world, such as the South African variant and variants from South America, that really have us concerned because the phenotypes that those viruses have suggest that they may be able to fly under the radar a little bit with regard to their susceptibility to antibodies that are generated against sort of the original versions of this virus. And so the Centers for Disease Control as well as a number of other agencies have devised this terminology for classification, variant of interest and variant of concern. And the last is variant of high consequence. And in order for a viral variant to be classified among those groupings, they have to satisfy certain criteria. And there are at least five viruses right now, five variants that are circulating that are of concern. And those include what's called the B117, which is the UK variant, and the South African variant, as well as three others that were characterized in Brazil.
And so for our listeners who are wondering, how concerned should we be about variants? We keep hearing this. Is the vaccine going to help me to avoid getting the variant? What would you say to them?
So at this point in time, there's a lot of data to suggest that the variants of concern that are currently on the radar, there's good data to show that the vaccine is providing coverage against those particular viruses. So the vaccines, of course, being those that are approved by emergency use authorization for use in the United States. We really need more scientific research, more epidemiologic data, and a number of other things have to be done to, assess the risk that these variants and future variants may possess. And that really requires scientists and public health officials and clinical laboratorians and others to sort of be the boots on the ground, gathering samples, doing nucleic acid sequencing in order to determine if any of those variants possess mutations in regions of their genomes that are relevant to, vaccine-based protection or antiviral drug-based protection, or the protection that's offered by a number of the antibody cocktails that are available for therapeutic purposes. So at this point in time, it looks as if the variants of concern that the Centers for Disease Control and other organizations have identified will be covered by current formulations of the vaccine. However, those viruses are continuously evolving. So in the future, it's conceivable that we'll be up against one or more variants that aren't covered so well. And in the potential for what's called vaccine escape mutants to arise also exists. Those are viruses that the vaccine will not provide a protective immune response against. And so then it's really up to scientists and researchers in all aspects of public health, including at the vaccine manufacturers, then to be mobilized and sort of take this massive effort and reformulation of the vaccine in order to generate a new version then that does work against those particular viruses.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say, it sounds like we're almost in this sort of position where the box has been opened, this virus is out there, it's going to keep mutating, possibly to a point where a vaccine doesn't work. I guess what I'm wondering is this, that's it, this is the rest of our future that we can see. There's never going to be an end to this.
So, I can't predict the future and nobody really can, but what has happened with other viruses similar to this, there are other coronaviruses out there. They're called human coronaviruses like OC43 and 229E and a few others. They've gotten out and we've never gotten them back in the box. Now, those viruses cause much less severe disease generally. A few of them are associated with the common cold. There was a virus that emerged in the early part of the 20th century called SARS coronavirus or SARS-CoV, or sometimes called SARS-CoV-1. That virus went away pretty quickly, and that required a concerted global effort to sort of stamp it out. And one of the things about that virus that lent to its containment, was the fact that people weren't really contagious when they were asymptomatic. Whereas with SARS-CoV-2, with what we're dealing with now, people can be asymptomatic and they can be transmitting the virus from themselves to other susceptible people. And so, there is a concern that we're just going to have to deal with this. And the history of modern civilization, we've been able to effectively stamp out one virus, and that's smallpox virus. Smallpox virus, though, did not have the ability to really spread into other animals and cause disease and mutate and potentially come back as a different form. SARS-CoV-2 and other coronaviruses like it, they can hop into other species. They can make cross-species transmission events possible. And during that time, whenever they're in other species, you can get sort of genetic and evolutionary exploration. You can get new forms of these viruses that are created and that could potentially spill back over into the human population. And they can look different to our immune systems. And not only that, the person-to-person transmission that we're seeing now, of course, you're getting these variants arise on a daily basis. You know, again, not all of them will have any staying power, but some of them will. And so, yeah, and you know, I'm sure your other folks you've had on the shows before have talked about the importance of getting vaccinated, and that's especially important in stamping these things out. You don't want to give them an inch because they will take a mile. They really will. You know, you give them the evolutionary possibilities. You know, you give them the opportunity, in other words, and they will evolve. And, you know, they're doing this without brains. They're just doing what they do. You know, there's a lot of personification of these viruses, but they don't know what's going on. You know, they're just responding to environmental stressors or things that are forcing them to evolve one way or the other. And in the process of that evolution, you know, you're not getting all viruses that are fit. What comes out of an infected cell is a mixture of virus particles. You're getting the ones that can go on and cause additional infections. And you're also getting a bunch of duds that come out, some of them that just aren't fit to move on. And those viruses die out. But yeah, so what we're seeing now, though, is sort of this massive, throughout the globe, massive number of infections, giving the virus sort of this massive evolutionary landscape. And vaccination is one way of sort of beating that down. Getting as many shots into as many arms as possible in a short duration will help minimize sort of that ability of the virus then to take more of a stronghold.
And what about when it comes to these variants? I think you mentioned there are about six right now. Are any of them in Indiana? And, you know, how worried should people be?
Yeah, as it turns out, those variants are in Indiana. You know, there's the UK variant is spreading here in Indiana, and there have been a few instances where a couple of the others have been detected by public health surveillance measures. And, you know, at this point in time, it's not really certain, you know, what type of additional concerns need to be raised. I mean, transmissibility has been shown to be heightened with the B117 variant and other things. But, you know, the good news is we've come a long way with regard to treatment. We know our enemy a lot better than we did a year ago. The healthcare providers, the doctors and nurses and everyone else really know what they're doing now with this. And we have the vaccine available, which should be taken by every person that has access to it. And also, you know, we're working on other things. There are researchers currently in laboratories right now throughout not just Indiana, but throughout the world that are evaluating the efficacy of drugs that could stop the infection, you know, once you get the virus. But, you know, what I generally tell people is continue practicing those disease transmission mitigation strategies, even if you are fully vaccinated. You just don't want to take the risk. You know, if there are variants out there flying under the radar, and if you're potentially susceptible to them, even if it just leads to a very, you know, innocuous infection, one that doesn't generate really bad signs and symptoms, maybe you could be, you know, a contagious to other people. So, you know, continue doing all the things that you've been accustomed to, you've gotten accustomed to over the past year. You know, keep that going.
You know, Moderna's CEO mentioned yesterday that they're hoping to have a booster shot for their two-dose vaccine by this fall to help fight against these variants. Are we going to see more, I guess, companies coming out with boosters to kind of try to tackle these variants? And are they going to be quick enough to tamp down on what seems to be spreading rapidly?
Well, you know, the answer to that question for both of those questions is I hope so. I have to imagine that a majority of the other manufacturers out there will sort of follow suit. They too will start manufacturing vaccines that protect against the variants as well. And it may become in the future where on an annual basis, we have to get boosters against, you know, prevalent variants, much like we do for influenza. You know, we generate vaccines and give new vaccines on an annual basis to cover variants of those viruses that have the likelihood of spreading throughout the community as well.
And what have you learned? You know, this is your field. You know all about this. Is there anything that surprised you at all in all of your years doing this work?
No, not really. I mean, most virologists, I think microbiologists and the sort have all been not very surprised. I mean, this is, of course, we were surprised, you know, whenever it actually happened. You know, virologists, public health experts, so on and so forth have been, you know, saying for years this sort of thing is going to happen, and now it happened. We were all hoping that there would have been a better response earlier in the game, right? We were hoping that people from all walks of life would have taken this a lot more seriously. You know, and from the virologist standpoint, you know, the SARS-CoV-2 is doing exactly what molecular biologists were predicting it would do. You know, it's continuing to evolve. All viruses do this. We're seeing a mutation rate that we expect. And so it's not, you know, really something that, you know, is too terribly surprising. And there's a lot of questions that people in the general public and even in the medical and the scientific community have is, you know, is this a biological weapon that was produced in a laboratory somewhere? And the answer to that is no. There are lots of other viruses similar to this virus that are currently circulating out in nature right now. And human activities really put us in front of the target. And we really then, you know, are doing things that lend to these viruses to spilling over from natural reservoirs. And just use other viruses as an example. Measles virus, for example, spilled over most likely from bovines, from cows a long time ago. There's a very similar virus that transmits among bovids. And chances are our domestication of cows led then to the opportunity for that virus to spill over and then evolve among humans and then become measles virus. And we're going to see a lot more of that happen. And I don't want to villainize animals because they don't know, you know, that these viruses are in them and that they're being transmitted. So we definitely then don't want to go out and, you know, start eradicating bat populations and other things. We just have to be smarter about the way we're doing so.
Right. Definitely. We do have to be smarter. Thank you so much. Ryan Relich is an associate professor of clinical pathology and laboratory medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Thank you so much for taking the time today. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Join us tomorrow as we find out how dentists have fared during the pandemic, among other topics. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.